Welcome to Conversations with Inspirations, the Neurology Section Oral History Collection. My name is Britta Smith, and I'm the historian of the Neurology Section and your host for an interview with Anne Shumway Cook. Few individuals have the sustained and tangible accomplishments that have truly impacted the profession of physical therapy as Dr. Shumway Cook. For over 25 years, she has advanced our understanding of the physiologic basis for abnormalities in balance and postural control. She has used her research and scholarly activities to always address real clinical problems. This body of work has influenced physical therapy provided to individuals with cerebral palsy, Down syndrome, Parkinson's disease, vestibular disorders, as well as those at risk for falls. Her two books, written in collaboration with Dr. Marjorie Woollacott, are used in physical therapy educational programs across the United States and the world. Many of us probably have one of her books on our professional bookshelves, either The Development of Posture and Gait Across the Lifespan or Translating Research into Clinical Practice. Her collaborative research publications, which include over 65 manuscripts and 17 book chapters, have produced some of the seminal work in balance and postural control. Joining me for that interview were Kathy Sullivan, Associate Professor of Clinical Physical Therapy at the University of Southern California and former President of the Neurology Section, and Teresa Jacobson Kimberly, Associate Professor at the University of Minnesota and Director of Research for the Neurology Section. Teresa was instrumental in establishing the Anne Shumway Cook Translating Neural Rehabilitation Research into Practice Lectureship established at CSM in 2011. It was truly an honor to have Dr. Shumway Cook share with us remembrances about her career and her thoughts about the physical therapy profession. Let's go back to the Combined Sections meeting in Chicago, Illinois, and listen to our interview held on February 11th, 2012.
Welcome, Kathy.
Hi, Britta. Nice to see you.
Great. And welcome, Teresa.
Hi, nice to see you.
And of course, welcome, Anne Shumway Cook, to our interview. And to start off, you began PT school in 1965 in Indiana University. What made you want to become a physical therapist?
I actually decided to become a physical therapist when I was about 12 or 13. So I was one of those people that identified early on. And part of it had to do with the fact that I actually grew up in a VA hospital. My father was chief of staff at the Cryle VA Medical Hospital in Cleveland, Ohio. And I grew up in the hospital initially and then on the grounds. And so was running around the hospital as I grew up and discovered the PT department. Met the PTs when I was about 12 or 13. They were incredibly gracious and kind to me. And then shortly after that, they had a student who was there doing an internship. And the faculty from Indiana University were there visiting that student. And I had the opportunity to meet the faculty from Indiana University PT school, two of them, and decided in that moment, not only did I want to be a PT, I wanted to go to Indiana University. So there you go. By 13, it was like highly focused, knew what I wanted to do and where I wanted to do it. So there you go.
So at that time, was it a bachelor's program and you entered directly into the program?
It was a bachelor's program. It was what they call a 2-2 program, where you go for 2 years, mm-hmm. freshman and sophomore year, at sort of general classes in Bloomington, Indiana. And then you applied to the PT program and then moved to Indianapolis and spent 2 years getting your PT.
So was your favorite class neurology?
I don't think that it was quite set up that way, actually. Mm-hmm. I think that we were encouraged in PT school not to identify ourselves with any one aspect of PT. It was terribly important at that time to be a generalist. And so, even though at the time I was heading towards pediatric mm-hmm. physical therapy, we were really strongly discouraged from identifying that early on.
Did they have clinicals or internships at that time?
Yes, there was one 8-week internship between the junior and senior year, And then at the end, you did 3 8-week internships at the end of your academics.
And then your it seems like your early career focused on treatment of children.
Yes.
That was your interest at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And so how do you how did these jobs with children shape your future career?
I had been interested in pediatrics for a long time and had the opportunity to practice in pediatrics. But children grow up.
Mm-hmm.
And so then I began to realize that the lifespan was really more my interest, that I couldn't really understand children and pediatric physical therapy without actually understanding the spectrum of problems that children face when they actually grow up. So I also feel like working in pediatrics helped me to understand some of the early factors that influence behavior when you're an adult, even an elderly person. So, yes.
So did your work with children on balance and posture kind of direct your interest as an adult in that same area?
Not directly, not the way you are thinking.
Mm-hmm.
I think your question has to do more with why did I specialize in balance and how did that happen? That's sort of what I'm feeling like your question really relates to. And I would say that my focus on balance really began when I started interacting with Lou Nashner, which was actually relatively late in the sense of before that, I don't think that I was any more focused on balance than any other clinical physical therapist is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're all focused on balance and the relationship of balance to physical function. But my passion for balance started really when I started in doing research with Lou, and I realized just how little I really understood this construct. And then it was like, holy smokes. I really thought I understood what balance was all about and thought I was doing a pretty good job in the clinic evaluating it and treating it, and realized that my concept of balance was not adequate. So
what was Lou working on at that time, and what did you work on in his lab?
He was doing research on normal balance control, normal posture control, using a moving platform paradigm to study postural reactive balance in normal people. So Lou was primarily working with normal people. And when I came along, I think he was interested because I was working with patient populations, in particular children with cerebral palsy.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had a very specific research question in mind when we started, which was when I first talked to him, went down to visit his lab, which was, I want to look at the effect of inhibitive casts on balance control in children with cerebral palsy. Stance balance control. And he said, well, what do we know about balance control in children with cerebral palsy who aren't in casts? And I said, well, I'm a PT. I know all about balance in children with CP and not a cast. And he said, well, why don't we just test some of those assumptions? And so we started the study with a grant from the Foundation for PT. And without them, thank you, Foundation for PT. We started this study, and basically this little 3-month study that I started with Lou, every assumption I had about balance in children with CP was not upheld by this research. And it really absolutely threw me for a loop, and I thought about getting out of the profession, frankly, because at that point it's like, wow, I don't know what to do now. And Lou fortunately said, why don't you just stay and we'll see if we can sort this out. And so, and I did. And
so
I've stayed ever since.
That was your transition from clinic to research.
Yes.
Yeah, and you know what's interesting to me, because you graduated in 1969, I graduated in 1978. So one of the things that I want to discuss with you is how together we've seen our profession evolve from what it was like to go to PT school then, and I'm like on your coattails.
Mm-hmm.
So, and kind of want to reflect on how different it is today and how we got here, because that's, I think, such an important part of how we've all evolved to where we are today. And so I guess I want to have you maybe describe what you, what physical therapy school was like for you. And then I can kind of compare what it was like for me. I imagine it was very, very similar. And then...
I don't think it will be similar.
Okay,
well, then you're going to find that there were significant differences in the 10 years since I graduated, but maybe not.
And this will be interesting because we had three... When did three-step happen compared to your graduation? I mean, sorry, new step.
New step. You're talking about new step.
Yeah.
So new step had happened in about, I think, 66. And so we had actually the new step proceedings in our curriculum.
Okay.
So, two things jump to mind in terms of what might have been different. Certainly what's different then when I went to PD school and what's different now. And I don't know about when you were 10 years later. So one of them is very just mundane, and that's the difference in uniforms. When I went to PT school, we had to wear uniforms, as did all the medical students and everyone else. Our uniform was a blue skirt, wraparound skirt, with blue shorts underneath, a white blouse, a white halter, and that's what we were required to wear every day.
Did you have a patch on your arm?
Yep.
What did men wear?
They wore blue pants and white shirts, and then they had blue shorts as well. So it was very standardized, and you had to wear those things.
So this is back when nurses wore the hats.
Yep. Well, and when I graduated from PT school, I had to wear a white uniform. No pants were allowed when I graduated from PT school in 1969. I had to wear a white dress, white stockings, and white shoes. So the only thing that distinguished me from a nurse was I didn't wear a cap. And it was a big deal when PTs were allowed to wear white pants, not just a white skirt. This was giant in our thing. It was like, holy smokes, we can wear pants. So that's one of the differences. So when you went to PT school, did you have to wear a uniform?
We wore a uniform, but we got to wear blue pants with a white top. And we all had to have our APTA patch on
the sleeve.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Same here.
Same here. Yep. Mm-hmm. So that was one difference. So nowadays, yeah, there's no uniform code in PT school. So, but I do think, speaking of New Step, I think that what we use as evidence for practice has changed considerably. And as I think about it, I think that's probably one of the most significant changes that has happened in our profession. Not sometimes for the good and sometimes not for the good. So when I went to PT school, evidence was based on professional opinion of people who were well-respected in the field. So the Berta Bobath, Margaret Rood, Sidney Brunstrom, the fact that these people had said this type of therapy works and is appropriate was sufficient evidence for us to go ahead and base our practice on that. So the opinion of respected clinicians was sufficient evidence, and that's what we were taught.
Now, I want to add something to that. I also have been told, I was at Northwestern as a junior faculty, and so there's a lot of Maggie Knott and...
PNF.
Yeah, PNF there a lot. And there was a lot of rivalry between these people.
Yeah.
And this, which is interesting, because I think this... They were experts, but they also had a little bit of rivalry between them. So there were camps, which ended up creating these approaches that I do think influenced our profession. And so maybe you could be thinking about that in your answer, too, is how did New Step, it created a kind of a neurophysiologic approach to physical therapy, which was good. But then there were also these approaches that emerged from that that brought us from post-polio era into this neuroscience area, if you will.
Yes, and I think that we, I think that that's always the case when personal opinion is the only foundation we have for evidence, because then we can become sort of disciples of a particular person's opinion, and that's the downside of it. And that's true nowadays as well as it is just as much as it was 40 years ago when I first began to practice. But I do think that you have a good point. So even the amount of time that was spent within my curriculum on these different approaches varied depending upon who was teaching and what their particular favorite was. I happened to have someone who was a Margaret Rood fanatic. And so, boy, we were trained in Margaret Rood's approach, and we got other things, a little bit of PNF and things like that. But so, so nowadays, as we think about what constitutes evidence in our practice, I sort of feel like we have shifted from professional judgment and opinion of people who are well-experienced to the opposite end, which is allowing research, even good research, to be the most heavily weighted evidence related to our practice. And I think that probably the reality is somewhere in between. I think that good research is integrated with good sound professional judgment based on experience and, as David Sackett said, and patient preference. And that's what constitutes evidence in our individual practice. So,
yeah, I totally agree with you. I think you watch these pendulums swing, don't you? So in that time, there was New Step, then there was Two Step. And I went to that, and now, you know, I've been in my career for a little over 10 years, I think. And what I recall from that time that, to me, was a kind of a paradigm push. I don't know if it was a full shift, but it focused on three areas that really did influence curriculum for physical therapists. And this is where your work and Faye's work and everyone's work started to make some sense to me, and Carolee's. It focused on three things: motor control, motor learning, and motor development. And I really think that was a pivotal moment in curriculum change, because we began to shift. And so, do you appreciate that your work helped us make that shift?
I think that many people's work did. So I'm not trying to be falsely humble regarding the contribution of my own work. I have been fortunate to collaborate with a lot of people, and I understand that the work that I published with and around others has been pivotal in the direction of the profession. I also feel like we stand on the shoulders of other people, and I find it particularly interesting that sometimes we are quick nowadays to dismiss the early neurofacilitation techniques, for example. And yet, think about it. These people, whether it's Rood or Bobath or Brunstrom, they were the first ones to say, you know, I believe that therapy can actually impact the nervous system. I believe we can actually modify the mammalian nervous system, if you will, and make changes. We don't have to just go the compensation route. And here we are, 50 years later, 40 years later, and the hot area right now is activity-dependent neuroplasticity. So all that's happened is we have confirmed something that they felt through their personal experience in the clinic. So I think it's important to remember that those people, those early therapists, were some of the first ones, in the absence of all of this research that we currently use to justify activity-dependent neuroplasticity, were saying, I believe there's activity-dependent nervous system modification going on. And so many of us who followed, whether it's Faye or myself or whoever, just went on the assumption we could modify the nervous system. This is like an enormous shift in perception. It never occurred to me that I couldn't modify the nervous system. Mm-hmm. And I have largely. So anyway, I think
that's critical, because another example is, and it kind of gets into why we're looking at imaging now and the importance of that maybe for the future, is if you look at Brunstrom and the Fugelmeier, and you need to understand that in terms of feuds, Ann Shumway Cook and I continuously feud over the value of the Fugelmeier. But what is very interesting to me is that the Fugelmeier is a reliable and valid measure of this selectivity that Brunstrom had described based upon her observations. And now, realizing that, in fact, her observations correlate with the amount of white matter tract damage in the corticospinal tract, and that actually the Fugelmeier score then is her observations are now confirmed by this imaging. And so it's amazing to me. And then you take motor learning, for example. It's another example of behavior. All those psychologists, so Carol Lee with, you know, Dick Schmidt, bringing in the observations that from a psychologic perspective, again, no confirmation that you could see learning, but that you could observe these changes in behavior, are now being confirmed with
neuroimaging.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So I think what you say is very important, and I really want to reinforce, as maybe we turn of a question to the next generation, of, you know, it's coming full circle, isn't it? And physical therapists observe behavior, they're trying to change function, and finally, actually, the scientists are catching up with us.
Well, I'm not sure I'd go that far, Kathy. I'm not sure. I think it's a collaborative process.
Absolutely. It's iterative. Yeah.
And the other thing is, yes, it is an iterative process. Mm-hmm. I think that's important. I think it's important not to, as they say, throw the baby out with the bathwater, mm-hmm. that to bring forward what we find most helpful rather than discard it or discount it or even worse, demonize it. And by that I mean just, you know, really discount it so that we are pejorative in our thinking. Well, you do this and you're wrong. So, and you're a bad therapist because of it. It's like, I think it's an iterative process and we need to just move forward, bringing forward those concepts that we feel are helpful and beneficial to our patients and allow others that may not be quite so helpful to either fall to the side or go into a resting state until we discover 20 years later that, gee, they actually are relevant. So there you go.
Well, and just a follow-up on that one point, and then absolutely, the other day there was a session on knowledge translation, and it was a beautiful thing, actually, to see today in the presentation that you were at, the sharing of feedback between clinicians and scientists and trying to understand how things work. We need to do more of that, I think.
Well, the other thing that I would just say, not to change the subject, but that I do feel has really changed in PT, fundamentally something that has really changed, and that is, and again, it's both good and bad. Mm-hmm. Actually, I think for the most part, it's good. And that is, it has to do with this issue of opinion and what we use as evidence. When I graduated from PT school, and really in the first 20, 30 years of my practice, the fact that I said my therapy was effective was sufficient evidence to get reimbursed. Mm. And so PT did not have to prove its efficacy. It did not. My opinion as a professional was sufficient in order to get fee-for-service. And now it's not enough. Now we have to show outcomes in relationship to our performance as in those interactions with a patient. And I think that that is important. It's very important. It does make it difficult because then we have to make decisions about what are the relevant outcomes that we should, in fact, be measuring. But I do believe one of the big changes in the profession has gone from PT works because I say it works to show me the money, as they say. So,
last year, the neurology section developed the Ann Shumway Cook Lectureship, Translating Evidence into Practice. And we had a wonderful conversation about, me and you and Kathy, about your resistance to having that named after you. And you alluded to what you talked about then a bit then, about nobody is alone, stand on the shoulders of giants and collaborative. But I wanted you to have the opportunity to have your response, your thoughts related to this, because you made really beautiful points, I think. And my vote would still be to keep it named the Ann Shumway Cook Lectureship, but because as Kathy said, your work has become synonymous, your name, I mean, has become synonymous with this concept. And I speak as somebody who did not know you personally. So I graduated in 1994. So yet another step.
Another generation.
And and in a large part due to your book and your work, that it is as though your name is no longer just the thing that your parents gave you. It is associated with this other thing. And that must be an awesome feeling to think that that might be true. So that is what I want, just have you comment on and have it recorded related to what your thoughts are about having something named after you.
Well, I'm ambivalent. On the one hand, I'm thrilled and delighted that you named a lectureship after me. Who wouldn't be, for heaven's sakes? It's like I've been in the field for over 40 years. It's like it's an incredible honor to have something named after you, particularly something for which you honestly believe your whole profession. The goal of myself in a professional role is related to that. That translation of research and helping therapists to understand the relevance of research to their everyday practice. I am a passionate proponent of that, as you know. And the give and take between research and researchers and clinicians, the importance of that. So, of course, I am incredibly grateful and honored that this would happen. Why do I feel that it should not be named after me? And I continue to feel it should not be named after me. And all I can say is the same thing I said last year. We honor a path, not the person. So I believe the name of the lectureship should be Neurology Section, Translating Research into Practice Lectureship. And we honor those people who are committed to the same thing I am, which is translating research into clinical practice. Every one of us is, as a therapist, that's my experience, is all clinicians are, in fact, desperately trying to improve patient care any way they can. That's one of the things that unites us as a profession, which is why I'm proud to be part of this profession. That said, there are so many people who are leaders in the field of translating research, doing their best to translate research into practice. And I believe that it's important to honor the path, not the individual. And so, and I still feel that way. So I do, I feel that way. I believe that the emphasis on an individual actually detracts from the emphasis on what it is we are celebrating, which is therapists' commitment to translating research into their practice. And there are many people that do it. So I still believe strongly that it should not have a name attached to it. And that's not just my name. It could be any name, I would say.
So I do understand what you're saying. And I remember walking with you at Three Step, and I assumed that Dr. Anne Shumway Cook, known for her translation, was a fellow of the American Physical Therapy Association. Now, there's an individual honor. In the neurology section, I found that she wasn't. And the neurology sponsored you to be a fellow of the American Physical Therapy Association. Now, what did that mean to you when you were nominated and then awarded a fellowship as a Katherine Worthingham Fellow? What did that mean to you? Because that's an individual thing.
Yes.
You're and not going to give that back, are you?
Oh, no.
Okay,
of course not.
Just
of course not. I was very honored, for a starter. I was really honored to be chosen as a Katherine Worthingham Fellow. There's no question about it. But I will tell you something truthfully. Maybe that honor doesn't mean as much to me as it might to other people. I'm honored to be in this profession. And that is sufficient for me. That's what you're not getting. I am part of a community of people that have supported me for over 40 years. And if I could say anything to therapists that are coming into the profession, it's that it's the sense of the fact that we are a community of people that are unified by our passion and compassion for patient care. And I am so proud to be part of this community. And that's what has supported me over the years, truly, more than any way I could possibly express, is the support that I have gotten and the sense of community.
So do you have a mentor, or did you have a mentor?
Absolutely, I had mentors. a strong proponent of mentors and collaborators. I believe that we do learn much more by who we are fortunate to collaborate with. And one of the first, obviously, was Lou Nashner. He's not a PT, but he was a person who mentored me in terms of research. Marjorie Woollacott would have been a second person who was probably incredibly, terribly influential, also not a PT, but helping me to understand the application of research to clinical practice. Both of those people were really, really instrumental for me. But the collaborations I've had with Faye Horak really helped. The interactions and collaboration, though he did not, we never shared research, were my father. And my father was a physician, and one of his last talks he gave, I have a quote from his last talk, at his retirement talk, that I have had in my office. And he said, and I feel it epitomizes PT, frankly, I do. He said, for man cannot live by scientific truth alone. It will always be relative. But a compassionate heart is the final and only absolute. And I believe that that's what physical therapy stands for. The science of physical therapy will change. What is unchanging in our profession is the compassionate heart and passion we bring to patient care.
Wow, I know. Bring the tissues, everybody.
Do I feel strongly with
it? It came across.
I have another question.
Sure.
Paradigm shift.
Yeah.
What resources do you have to call upon within in order to lead a paradigm shift within a school of thought? Because you have done that throughout your career. You have led people to change the way they think. And that is not an easy thing to do. It is easy to continue to do what we have always done. It is easy to make a contribution and sort of let it sit there. What kind of advice could you give burgeoning researchers, mm-hmm. clinicians?
I think one of the most important things for me in terms of a willingness to change, that is ultimately at the heart of your question. How willing are you to change? And though we say we're willing to change, it's very, in fact, hard to change. And partly, I believe, that one of the most difficult things is finding out you're wrong. And so our ego is attached to being right. Our ego is attached to knowing what we're doing. And it's very disconcerting to find out that we don't, or that we, in fact, might even be wrong. And so I think the most important thing to personal characteristic related to paradigm shifts is, one, the recognition that change is necessary, and not to be ego attached to a specific thing. And that's true whether you're a therapist and your ego attached to a particular type of therapy, or you're a researcher who is ego attached to a particular hypothesis. You have to be willing to be wrong in order to move ahead. And so, and that's a very hard thing, I think, for all of us, is to recognize the need for change and the fact that change is uncomfortable, and I might have to live through a certain level of discomfort before I can find my way out.
This is the end of the first half of our interview with Dr. Shumway Cook. You can continue listening to our conversation by downloading the second half of this interview when Dr. Shumway Cook shares stories about her professional collaborations, early work in vestibular therapy with Faye Horak, and her vision for the future of the physical therapy profession.